One, two, three, four.
Where do creative thoughts come from? And how can we harness our stream of consciousness and spontaneity to express ourselves? How are mind wandering, meditation, and the arts good for our creativity, physical, and mental well-being?
Ben Shofty is a functional neurosurgeon currently affiliated with the University of Utah. He graduated from the Tel Aviv University Faculty of Medicine, received his PhD in neurosurgical training from the Israeli Institute of Technology, and completed his training at the Tel Aviv Medical Center and Baylor University. He was also an Israeli national rugby player. His practice specializes in neuromodulation and exploring treatments for disorders such as OCD, depression, and epilepsy, among others, while also seeking to understand the science behind creativity, mind-wandering, and the many complexities of the brain.
Dr. Ben Shofty, welcome to the creative process.
Thank you. I'm super excited and happy to be here.
So your practice focuses on neuromodulation for psychiatric disorders, surgical treatments for cancer pain, as I understand, movement disorders and epilepsy. It's a broad spectrum, but in your lab, you investigate high-order cognition and network-dependent functions such as creativity and mind wandering. You're involved in advanced imaging and visual biopsies. So let's start with creativity. We know that creativity is elusive, and you've written about this because we still don't know exactly what happens in our brains when we're being creative. How do you define creativity in the context of those higher order functions and the default mode network? Because you've written that there is not a creativity cortex, per se, located in a specific location in the brain.
Yes, that is 100% true. So I think in terms of creativity, we usually use the accepted definition, which is any thought process that is novel and useful, meaning it's an idea that is relatively rare in terms of frequency, but it's also useful in order for something to be creative. And that can be verbal creativity or visual creativity or artistic creativity. And there's, you know, it's a whole world. But I think the common thing that happens whenever somebody is doing a creative process is that we have an infrequent connection between two or more thought processes that weren't meant to be connected. That's when we get that, you know, sort of eureka moment, when we were able to sort of fuse two things that or more that weren't meant to be fused, and we generate something that is actually great. And to me, you know, this is one of the most interesting things that the human mind sort of evolved and specialized to do.
And in terms of your own experience of creativity, I think you have a really interesting background because you were a former national rugby player in Israel. You've experienced creativity in the lab, or even as a surgeon, you must be coming up with solutions in the moment. You know, some people might not label that as creative, but when it's high stakes or something unexpected happens during surgery, I imagine you have to use some creative problem solving to turn it around. And in that moment, I think creativity can really save a life. So often there's this split second thinking that's hard to track what's happening in the creative mind. Can you speak about the more elusive processes like creativity or high order cognitive functions where we can see creative sparks emerge?
So I feel when you think about the evolution of the human brain, just like other animals have sort of specialized in speed or keeping warm or, you know, gathering food, I feel like our brain specialized into being creative and flexible and being able to generate different solutions to a given problem. And to me, it's not written in my bio or anywhere else, but I used to cook a lot and I used to work in cooking. And to me, this is the most creative process, right? Taking something and generating a taste or a flavor or something completely different out of it. I think that to me, this is probably the most fascinating thought process that happened in the human brain. And the fact that I do inside of neurosurgery, my subspecialty, as you said, it's called functional neurosurgery. And in functional neurosurgery, we don't deal with disorders in which there's an anatomical abnormality inside the brain. We deal with disorders in which there is abnormal connection or abnormal circuitry inside the brain. And there's an issue with the way the brain functions. There's no tumor. There are no abnormal blood vessels or anything like that. And that gives us an amazing opportunity to really investigate how different circuits and different areas inside the brain works. But in terms of, as you said, more elusive processes like creativity or high-order cognitive functions, we don't really know or understand where they are inside the brain. There's no creativity cortex like we have motor cortex or sensory cortex or visual cortex. So when we started with this project or series of projects, we tried to think if this function, just like other higher cognitive functions, cannot be explained by a specific area inside the brain, then what happens? Where does the magic happen? And the answer, as you said, was that it's a network-dependent function. It doesn't originate from a specific area inside the brain, but it originates from multiple brain networks sort of all of a sudden synchronizing to generate that unexpected function.
Exactly. It's what's going on without our knowing. There's an intentional level. I think that there's multiple levels, and you may go into this more. There's an intentional level. There's the subconscious with these things that are going on, humming beneath the surface without our knowing. And perhaps it's a conversation between those different levels or ways of being aware and being unconscious of our creative activity and how they communicate with each other and then to us, in that the creativity expresses itself finally in the world. Perhaps you can expand on that and set me straight if I have that wrong.
Yeah, no, you said that beautifully. In our lives, and one of the things that makes us human is that we have a spontaneous stream of consciousness, right? There's a constant sort of thought process that's internal and unique to us as individuals that constantly accompany us throughout our lives, right? There's always a voice and a stream of thoughts that's happening in the background. Today, we think that spontaneous stream of consciousness is generated by a brain network, which is called the default mode network. And people called it a default mode network because initially nobody understood what it does. People knew that it's active whenever we're not busy directing our attention to a specific task. So that's when people understood that this network is working. And with time and a lot of studies that are based on fMRI, people have started understanding this network is actually in charge of that spontaneous stream of thoughts, of remembering the past, of imagining the future, everything that we do that's introspective. And that network is basically what makes us human. And when it's working well, it's great. But we have some states in which that network is overactive or underactive, and we associate these states with various types of mental illnesses like depression, schizophrenia, and a bunch of other mental illnesses. And I think that spontaneous stream of thought is what stands in the basis of the creative thought process. Because a lot of the times, and there are people who are professionally creative, right? If you talk about Stephen King or Jerry Seinfeld, these people are creative for a living. So they know how to channel this internal thought process and generate these unexpected connections in order to generate the same sort of type of creativity, whether it's, you know, a book or a joke or something else. And there are many other people that can harness creativity. For the most of us, it's a process that starts with that spontaneous stream of thought when all of a sudden the default mode network synchronizes with other brain networks that sort of channel that internal mental process into generating something that is useful or helpful or something like that. So there's a specific moment in which our internal stream of thought is synchronized with a goal-directed or intentional network. And that's when the creative process happens. And that's the sort of magic that we were trying to find or analyze with the study that you're talking about.
Yes. And to go a bit more into that, I'm an artist and writer too, so I have a little understanding of it. I love the idea of when the stream of consciousness takes over, and those who are professional, they can just go to the source a bit more frequently, but it could be a process of meditation. You mentioned Jerry Seinfeld. I know that he meditates, transcendental meditation, and that's something that you're interested in. And sometimes, as you hinted at, some of our best ideas come to us from out of nowhere. We can arrive at it through the meditation or taking a walk, and these unconscious acts kind of bring what's bubbling under the surface to the surface. The Shaolin monks have this trust in the flow of life, and they allow it to guide their discipline. And of course, there's many well-known, you mentioned writers, Stephen King, or songwriters, where they talk about a song came out of nowhere and kind of wrote itself because they emptied themselves enough to be like a vessel for this inspiration, for lack of a better word. It's this kind of quality of otherness. How can we track down this phenomena and look at it in a since so often these acts of creativity take place outside of the lab?
So I think scientific reductionism helps us take this amorphic concept and break it down into various stages. And one of my collaborators, Roger Beatty, who's really invested a lot of time into looking into or breaking down the creative process, suggested and supports a model that we call the Gensplore model. It's basically a generation and exploration model. We, of course, take an easier route and we don't wait for an inspiration, but we have a task that challenges people and helps guide them to perform creative thinking. It's called the alternate users task. But in that task, we stimulate people into generating multiple possible solutions to a given problem and then exploring or evaluating these solutions to choose the most creative one. It doesn't encompass the entire magic that's involved in creativity, but it allows us to start to reveal, you know, the thought processes that eventually generate a creative thought. So the first stage is a person that's facing a given problem, whether it's writing a book, drawing a picture, or getting into his house after he forgot his keys. These are all situations in which you need to be creative. And then they start generating multiple solutions to that problem, multiple lyrics to the song, multiple mental images for the drawing, and multiple ways to break into the house. And eventually, through experience and episodic memory and a lot of other more goal-directed executive functions, they choose the best ones. But this process is, of course, very fast and very streamlined. And in order for that process to be very fast and very streamlined, you have to somehow synchronize the default mode network with other cognitive networks. So that's basically what you just said. And people find various ways of driving that synchronization, whether it's meditation, whether it's walking in the forest, whether it's psychedelic drugs. There's a lot of different ways to sort of generate or initiate that process. And the interesting thing is that some people know how to initiate that process and are better at that. And some people are more creative and some people can be, as we said, professionally creative and train that process just like any other muscle in the body to a point where they're better at activating it. A lot of other people just rely on luck or on timing or inspiration to do that.
Better not only to rely on luck, although luck is wonderful when it arrives. Yes. There are some things that we can tap into innately. And you mentioned the brain being a muscle like any other, and it makes me think about muscle memory that you must have experienced as a rugby player or musicians. Because, you know, I've just written a book about creativity and it's called Jazz and Literature. It's coming out soon. And it brings together some of my interviews with a variety of artists. And we talked about improvisation because I've talked with a number of free improvisers like Dickie Landry, who improvises solos for hours live on stage. And he's kind of amazing because it's not just jazz musicians who improvise. He's worked with Aretha Franklin, Philip Glass, Robert Plant, Paul Simon, David Byrne, the Talking Heads. And he talks about the experience of going into a kind of a trance when he's performing and waking up a few hours later and wondering, like, what's just happened? So it's really fascinating because I think you've probably seen these studies where they've taken fMRI scans of musicians while they're making music improvisationally.
It's not by rote. It's nothing like that. They're given a prompt and they create lyrics or music spontaneously. And that there's something that takes place in the improvising mind, but I think that takes place in the creative mind in general, where the kind of sense of self disappears and the project or the movement takes over. And when they studied these musicians who improvise, the kind of sense of self, I don't know how you locate it directly in the brain, but that is turned off more in them. And in that way, they're able to tap into what we're talking about. This, maybe it's a collective intelligence or whether it's a muscle memory or something that is from outside of themselves that helps them create spontaneously at a fast rate.
Exactly. So I think, and I'm familiar with the studies that you've just described with jazz players that underwent fMRI or EEG while basically improvising and playing jazz, which is, again, is a philosophical question whether it's improvising or just talking a different language, right? But I feel, and based on our study, I think a reasonable assumption to what happens there is that, again, they're basically directing the default mode network. Instead of generating that self-awareness and spontaneous stream of thought, it's generated or driven into generating this constant creation or creative process. And by doing that and by synchronizing it for a relatively long period of time, right? We're talking minutes. And while generating a creative thought is a process that takes milliseconds. So if you channel it or drive it towards generating a constantly creative thought process, then I would assume that it's not doing what it usually does, which is generating that sense of self. And this is why a lot of people, when they write, for an instance, they get lost in writing. And then it happens to all of us that we do something that's really creative, paint, or we play an instrument, or we write, and it feels like time went by in a second because we directed the cognitive resource that we usually direct into maintaining that stream of consciousness and sense of self and time sensation into that creative process.
Exactly. And it's not quite the same as an automation, which we're saying going on beneath the surface, but I imagine you could perhaps illuminate as a former rugby player. It's very much intentional, but if you had to slow things down and say, if I move my foot at this angle, at this speed, it will arrive in the goal, but you can't wait that long. You just have to act. But if you break it down, it is an intentional process. It's just the difference is a question of speed, right?
Exactly. So it's a matter of processing speed, and it's a matter of the cognitive resources that you use. And as you said, muscle memory, and there's a lot of things that intertwine in order to generate that very fast response. And I feel that with enough practice, the same thing happens with the creative thought process. And it becomes a very fast and intuitive sort of process if you've done that enough times and you've practiced it enough and you have the natural tendency and ability to do that. And that's something that we see a lot with jazz players. That's probably the extreme sort of example for them.
Exactly. They have no time to stop and think, but there's all that intuitive intelligence. So you had mentioned earlier schizophrenia, other areas where you make interventions as a surgeon. I know that's not your specific area, but there's, of course, a dark side to creativity where high levels of creative mania are linked to certain mental health challenges, bipolar episodes or euphoria, the schizophrenia. And, you know, I'd always thought that neurosurgical treatments for mental health disorders are complex and could be high risk. But I understand you work in an area where 60 to 70% of patients respond well to the treatment. So what are the biggest challenges you face in translating your research into practical, safe and widely available treatment for these disorders like OCD, depression, and PTSD?
Thank you for asking that. OCD is a very relatively simple or understood disorder. We have a very specific brain circuit that is sort of in charge of the enhancement of obsessive thoughts and the following compulsions. So when we intervene with the OCD circuitry, and there's a lot of amazing work done by my former mentor at Baylor, Samir Sheth, and Nicole Provenza from his group, that are doing really amazing stuff in terms of dissecting that circuitry that leads to these recurrent obsessions and compulsions. I feel like it's a really different thing. And of course, interventions for OCD are FDA approved. So that's something that we do on a routine clinical basis. There are other mental health conditions like depression and schizophrenia, as you said. And I'm intentionally bringing up these two because the way I see them, they represent two different types of default mode dysfunction. For example, depression has many subtypes and it's apparently many different disorders. But one of the subtypes that we're studying in my lab is what we call rumination type depression. It's the depression type in which people keep ruminating and keep focusing on their internal thought process, and they just cannot shake off and concentrate on anything that happens in the outside world. And that sort of represents a very pathological activation of the default mode network, right? That spontaneous stream of thought that we know that exists. Okay, if I have to drive or allocate my cognitive resources towards the outside world, when somebody has rumination type depression, they just can't do that. And they keep on ruminating and they keep on thinking about things that have happened and they just can't shake them off. And that leads to significant depressive symptoms. And the other side of that default mode dysfunction is, for example, schizophrenia at the beginning of the disease, where they're very active and patients are really stormy and they have a lot of psychosis, which is the inability to differentiate external stimuli from internal stimuli. So they have a lot of auditory and visual hallucinations. And basically the default mode network is so hyperactivated that you can't tell the difference between what's happening inside your brain to what's happening outside. So these are two extreme conditions of what some people think is default mode network dysfunction or network dysfunction inside the brain that are also overlapping with the creative thought process, right? Because in order for something to work well in the brain or in the body, We need everything to be balanced, right? We need everything to be just right. And the entire biological system that is the brain or the body is generated to support that balance. Once an imbalance happens, and that can happen for a lot of different reasons that honestly we don't understand most of them, but that can generate states of extreme hyper default mode activation or creativity. But then it's not creativity because it's not really useful, right? If somebody is having hallucinations or tries to do creative processes from a manic starting point, then it's, of course, not creative, but it's a pathological state.
Indeed. And it's great if you can have these interventions that help them uncover what is the germ of that creativity, which is so clouded and tangled by the overlapping disorder or difficulties they're experiencing. So as I understand, you do deep brain stimulation, again, not always for schizophrenia. I guess it's your main focus is the OCD, depression, PTSD, but you are treating lesions or the vagus nerve stimulation. Just explain to us what that means.
So first of all, in terms of the default mode, I think that what we try to do in my lab is, first of all, understand how the network works when everything is okay, right? When everything works well. And that's the basis to us being able to understand pathologies that are associated with the network. We have to really understand what happens in the normal condition, in the normal person, in the non-diseased state. We have a lot of correlative evidence from fMRI studies, but our approach, which uses electrodes that are implanted inside the brain, and we can talk about it more later, helps us understand how the normal brain signal transduction happens on a millisecond kind of level and in multiple areas inside of the brain. So the first thing that we're trying to do is characterize the default mode network in the normal brain. And from that, we're trying to take it to pathological state like the rumination type depression. We've talked about it's still very far from actually basing interventions based on that, but hopefully one day we will get there. In terms of the other things that you've mentioned, the different types of neuromodulation, I think an OCD or epilepsy are both great examples for network disorders. It's a disease or disorder in which there's an issue with the brain network, not necessarily a specific area inside the brain. If we understand that network and if we have a reasonable understanding of what happens inside that network, then we can try and intervene. And intervening has many different ways. It can be a brain pacemaker, like a DBS, deep brain stimulator, or an RNS, responsive neurostimulator. It can be something that has a sort of a calming effect on the brain, like a vagal nerve stimulator. It can be a lesion study in which we sort of turn a specific spot inside the brain to break an abnormal hyperactive circuit. And there are many disorders, and the more we understand the brain, there are more and more things that we can intervene aside from just epilepsy and movement disorders, which are Parkinson's disease and tremor and dystonia. But today we offer neuromodulatory treatments for epilepsy and, as you said, for OCD, and we're starting to investigate the different types of depression, treatment-resistant depression. We're even looking into rehabilitation and addiction, many other processes that are not necessarily associated with a specific area inside the brain, but with a network dysfunction.
Yes, and I wonder, you've written about mind wandering and been talking about meditation. And so mind wandering is, I think, often considered to be a form of mental rest, but on the flip side, it can also lead to this negative rumination that you've discussed. What are some of the ways beyond what you've already discussed to harness mind wandering for mental resilience, especially in those individuals with a predisposition to anxiety or depression?
So that's a great question. So mind wandering is another basic function that we associate with the default mode network. And again, our ability to mind wander can be a positive thing, right? If we harness it into a mental break or rest or something like that, it's the extreme form of that is probably meditation. And it can be a bad thing if we basically are unable to concentrate with everything and our mind constantly wanders. And it becomes a really big issue today with all screens and social media. And our ability to generate positive mind wandering is getting lost because our attention span has become a TikTok length, sort of an attention span. And our ability to just allow our mind to wander in a healthy ways is getting lost. So a lot of people are interested in the changes that happen with that very basic and critical form of thinking or of spontaneous thought. It's hard to investigate, and we haven't had a very big success in investigating it because most of the patients that I work with have underwent surgery or an invasive intervention, and the setting is very hard. They're having a hard time basically mind wandering. So we're looking into that, but I cannot tell you that we've had a lot of success. I still have not had a patient who is a professional meditator, and they're having a lot of difficulties basically mind wandering with the task because they're in a hospital room, they've underwent surgery, there's a lot of screens and everything. So it's something that I'm really interested in, but unfortunately, I can't tell you that I've had a lot of success finding that or working or being able to generate significant enough mind wandering so that we can record the activity and understand what's happening.
Oh, wow. Of course, it has to be within the context of your surgeries, I'm imagining, because it sounds funny to say, I know a lot of people whose minds wander. No, but I do know people who are, we're talking about...
Everybody's mind wanders.
No, but I do know professional, like the head of the Shaolin monastery in Europe. So if you ever want to reach out to those, if they don't have to be operated on, I'm not sure if they're...
Yeah.
They, as you say, these professional mind wanderers, I think usually prefer the non-surgical. As you say, the surgical intervention is the last step when the other interventions could not be successful, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the way we study these functions and networks in my lab, and there's many other people that are doing the same, is that we basically ask our patients that are undergoing surgery, and it's usually a surgery that we call stereo EEG or intracranial monitoring. And these are patients usually with intractable epilepsy, meaning their epilepsy has not responded to any form of drug therapy or anti-epileptic drugs, and that we know, and they're still suffering or experiencing seizures despite taking an adequate dosage of anti-epileptic drugs. And we think that their seizures are coming from a specific spot inside the brain, but we don't know where. So our next step is to offer a surgery that is called, again, stereo EEG or depth electrodes, in which we basically implant the electrodes inside the brain. And then we monitor these patients to try and understand where the seizures are coming from. And it's a very effective and safe surgery that helps us really understand their epilepsy on a network level. And then we can potentially offer them a surgery to intervene with that network or to take care of their epilepsy. During that time, they spend about a week or 10 days at the hospital waiting to seize enough time so that we understand their epilepsy. But there's a lot of dead time in which they just sit in their room and watch TV. So we offer them and we tell them, if you're interested, we have a bunch of research studies that you're welcome to be a part of. And most of them are interested in participating because it's a lot of fun. It helps them pass the time and it gives them some sort of a meaning, and they can potentially help other patients that suffer from other disorders. So a lot of them say, yes, I'm happy to participate. And that gives us a very unique opportunity in which we have an awake, behaving, fully conscious human being with electrodes inside their brain. And that's what makes these studies relatively unique, because nobody will implant patients, especially to study creativity, right? Nobody will agree to that. No sane human being will undergo a brain surgery just so he can help us understand more about the default mode network or any other type of network. But these patients have already underwent their implant for clinical reasons and they're happy to participate. And it gives us a unique opportunity in which we can record from multiple areas inside the brain while they're performing the task. In addition to that, we can deliver stimulation through the electrodes and manipulate a specific brain network or a specific brain area. And that way we can prove causality. And that's one of the things we did in the paper that you've read. We actually stimulated the default mode network. And we've shown that when we desynchronize the default mode network or interrupt its activity, people are not able to generate uses that are as creative as they were able to generate before or without stimulation. So that was a really strong proof of causality that the default mode network is the driving force behind, or the driving network behind, our ability to generate creative thoughts.
My name is Eva Sanborn, and I am a student at Brandeis University studying English and history. Something that really stood out to me about this discussion is just how interconnected the arts and sciences truly are. At first, when I started working on this episode, I felt a bit nervous about the fact that I tend to feel more comfortable discussing things like the humanities, and I've often felt out of place when it comes to discussions about STEM-related topics. I was worried that I was completely out of my depth. However, I think what this episode and its discussions on the neurological science of creativity has proven to me is that there shouldn't be some sort of rigid boundary between the sciences and humanities, because they exist alongside each other and they can help us understand one another. Any boundary that we've created is an artificial one, and the greatest innovations can be made when different kinds of creatives come together and try to look at the world from new perspectives. As a student attending a university, I find it disheartening how students who study STEM and students who study social sciences and the humanities are often pitted against each other and seen as entirely separate or distinct. Lately, the humanities have been devalued by society, and STEM is treated as the only worthwhile options for students. This can lead to a division between us, but these divisions are not productive or even rooted in reality. In the real world, people with different talents and backgrounds are always working together, and people often have diverse interests and can simultaneously be passionate about scientific subjects and the arts. Creative thinking encapsulates so much, and these modes of thinking can just as easily be applied to surgery as they can to painting. Instead, I think we should encourage all students and all curious people by extension to explore beyond their academic comfort zones and work in tandem with people who have different skill sets from them. All kinds of creativity and intelligence should be valued because they all have a part in improving the world. Now back to the interview.
Drawing back a bit further, we're really at a frontier. I don't know what you think about the possibility of neural implants for creativity and the use of AI in medical imaging, of course, diagnostics and beyond. Do you foresee, I have a few questions on this, I'm really curious. Do you foresee a future where such technology could be used to augment or directly tap into the creative process of the brain? Do you see the potential benefits or risks of such advancements?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm one of the people that believe that anything that we as human beings can imagine will eventually happen. So I feel like if somebody has raised the possibility of having brain implants that augment the brain and generate additional functions, I feel like it will eventually happen. And there's a lot of private companies like Elon Musk's Neuralink and others that are busy designing these interfaces and planning these devices. And of course, nothing is available or is even close to completion right now. But the more we understand how these computations inside the brain work and how these networks work, and the more we are able to characterize them and to understand their ability to generate these thought processes, these functions, that the next step would be, of course, to modulate them. Just like any other thing in medicine, it will start or it has already started with pathological states, which we've talked about, and people that are looking for potential interventions through TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. It doesn't necessarily have to be invasive. But of course, the next step, especially when we're talking about brain, is to intervene and generate additional functions or to improve on the way the brain functions. And there are many people that are working on trying to generate memory augmentation and navigation augmentations and a lot of other functions. And I assume eventually it will reach a point where we'll be able to pick and choose what we want to augment about our own brains. We do that as human beings. We do that already, right? If you go to a specific school and you study something or you have the ability to practice something over and over again, you augment your brain towards that direction. It's just not an artificial sort of augmentation. I assume that the technology will be there eventually, and this is something that will be a part of the natural evolution of the human race.
Yes, I'm not sure if I'll be the first guinea pig. I think, follow me, said the wise man as he walked behind. I think I'll do that.
Exactly. I agree 100%. These are not the things that you want to be the first, right? But take a look at Neuralink. They've already implanted 2 patients and trying to restore motor function, which is the obvious target for brain implants. And I think a lot of people will eventually be interested in augmenting other more higher cognitive functions.
Yes. And so on that note, in general, what are your views on AI in integrating with your own advanced imaging techniques in your field? And how might that impact the precision and outcomes of neurosurgical procedures?
Again, AI is a tool, basically. Neural networks is a computational tool. It's something that we utilize a lot in our lab and in the research that we're doing. Some of the network estimations and calculations and synchronizations are very data rich, and it takes a lot of computational power to understand what's happening. So we utilize a lot of neural networks or AI in order to do that. And again, just like any other tool in the history of the human race, it can be utilized for the benefit of everybody, or it can be utilized to do horrible things. Yeah, it's just a tool, and the people that are using it can use it to do whatever they're interested in. The more we understand the brain and the more sophisticated our brain implants will become, I feel like it'll take a bigger part in that, just because if we want to restore or replicate the brain function, we need a mechanism or a device that can perform that computation in an efficient and fast enough way so that it matches the functions of the brain. And we're still not there, but it'll eventually get there.
Wow, it's very interesting times. And when I read that AI makes non-invasive mind reading possible on a basic level, I guess,
yeah,
you can now in some way turn thoughts into text. So what does this tell us? How does this breakthrough in AI-based mind reading technology, how does that make you reflect on traditional notions, the origins of language or the boundaries of the extended mind theory? It's not all here. If you can communicate, well, I guess a lot of animals also communicate on this level as well.
So I think our ability to basically decode what happens in the brain is getting better by the year, right? There's constant breakthrough, and what you're referring to, the amazing work that's being done by Eddie Chang at UCSF, basically decoding speech with brain electrodes, with arrays that are overlaid on the cortical surface. I mean, it's amazing. And it utilizes a lot of very sophisticated technology in order to do that in real time. And the more we research into the way the brain works and the more we understand how brain networks and different areas function, our ability to decode different things becomes better. Right now, we're able to decode motor function to a good degree. We're starting to be able to decode speech. In my lab, we're trying to basically to decode the creative process. So right now, I have a brilliant postdoc student, Ricky Rabinovich, who's doing an amazing study, and she's trying to decode ideas that are highly creative versus ideas that are not as creative just by analyzing the changes in the default mode network. And she's starting to see amazing results, in which she can tell you if the patient performed well on the test, meaning that they were highly creative or not, without even hearing what they're saying, just based on their changes in the default mode network. So she's basically able to decode what happens in the brain when we do creative thinking to a higher degree.
Yes, I would love to read more into that. I neglected to ask you, I think it's such a natural topic of curiosity, but what drew you to studying the mind, the brain, creativity, all these things? What was your way in?
So I think the main thing and the reason I went into neurosurgery, because it gives you the most intimate sort of understanding of what happens in the brain. And I think when you operate on a patient, when you implant electrodes, when you do a resection for epilepsy or any other type of brain surgery, it sort of puts you in a position where you basically understand the significance of the brain and the changes that the brain undergoes. And a great example, my old boss in Tel Aviv, Professor Zvi Ram, we used to see our patients, post-operative patients together, and they used to tell us, I can walk and I can talk, but I don't feel the same person. And that spot where a person is walking and talking and is seemingly okay on the outside, but they don't feel like they're the same person or they've underwent a major change, that's the spot that sort of drew my mind and made me really interested in studying what makes us ourselves. And I thought that creativity is one of the main things that happen to us that sort of define our uniqueness as human beings, because it's a very personalized thought process, right? Everybody is creative in a very unique and special way. So to me, it was as somebody who's basically interested and likes other human beings, to me, the question, what makes us unique and what makes us human, sort of distills itself into figuring it out what happens when we are creative.
Yes, and it's amazing where our curiosity takes us and creates a path for us to pursue. And you've chosen a really interesting one to journey upon.
And it's a very interesting question, you know, what makes us ourselves and how do our early life experience, because you mentioned growing up in Israel, you were trained in Israel, and you've also, of course, we've been talking about also depression and PTSD and how these kind of experiences can imprint upon us. I just wonder what of your early life experiences might have also drawn you to the subject of wanting to learn how the mind works and learn how to make it function in a better way. And also how maybe your military training, how did that imprint upon you in terms of working with the collective, working towards goals?
Yeah. So when I was a kid, I really liked two things, reading and cooking. I think both of them require a lot of creativity to do. And I do both, but I'm not very good at them. And that stimulated me towards thinking and trying to figure out how these processes happen in people that are very good at them. And I think that was my main drive into that area of research in terms of trying to understand how creativity works inside the brain. Yeah, I think the military training is the exact opposite, right? They're trying to make you not creative. And that maybe also pushed me towards that direction.
Yeah, maybe not creative, but it's interesting how teams work. And I think the intuition of teams, the wisdom of teams and that kind of things, I think that might apply. I don't know. I've never had that background, but something about the training, it's not one-to-one with meditation, but it is something I imagine about focus and discipline and maybe creative visualization, or at least a visualization process when you're working with large groups of people.
Yeah. Yeah, I 100% agree. What's interesting about meditation is that people that are professional meditators, their default mode network is not hyperactive, but it's underactive when they meditate. So basically, when they meditate, they sort of break free from their spontaneous stream of consciousness. That's how meditation should work. But it's interesting to see it happens in real life when you put Tibetan monks in the fMRI or see what happens with EEG, with surface EEG electrodes when they meditate, the default mode network is being suppressed. And that's amazing to see because it becomes a goal-directed activity. And that doesn't happen in people meditate as a hobby.
Yeah, it takes many years, many hours to get to that level.
And yes.
And you mentioned, so with meditation, of course, it's about lowering that noise, narrowing that beam. And the opposite of that is social media, where everything is happening all at once. There's this ongoing debate about how social media and digital environments can potentially, speaking about young people particularly, but all of us, negatively impact our mental well-being, considering the numerous studies that you've seen explored that link between social media and reduced psychological well-being and those increased levels of depression and low self-esteem. So what are your views on that? How do we protect ourselves and young people?
Yeah, so again, that's another philosophical question, whether this is our next step in evolution, right? Where we don't have to concentrate and we don't have to focus our attention on anything, but we need to be able to follow 20 different stimuli all at once. Maybe that's the way the human race is walking to, and maybe that's the next sort of attribute that we need to be successful in the future world. I don't know. I do agree that a lot of evidence, a lot of scientific evidence are pointing out that these are not healthy processes and that they significantly impair our mental health and our well-being. And I think that the best way is just to try and postpone it to a late age as possible. I feel like it's not my area of expertise, but from as having kids and reading about it, I feel like the best thing to do is to try and minimize the exposure to these social networks and online media in younger ages. And also to find something that gives us a break from these things that are constantly hovering around us, right? They're so available, the phone, the screens, all of these things. If we can give ourselves and our loved ones a chance to get a break from that during their day, I feel like this will help minimize the effect.
So in these times, you reflect on meditation and connecting with the natural world and those kind of ways in to become who our best selves, our truest self, or who we are when our mind is at rest and focused. So could you share your reflections on the beauty and wonder of the natural world, the different ways you tap into your creativity?
Yeah, I moved to Utah, which is a very beautiful place. And I feel like the mountains and the very breathtaking nature that we have around here really helps. And we know that there are many studies that have shown that exposure to nature and spending time in nature really helps us. It helps our well-being as human beings, and it also helps us to be creative and reflective and calm. The way my personal creative process works is through interaction with other people, through genuine interest in other people, and through interaction and spending time with other people. These are the times where, you know, through talking to people like you or friends or family or strangers, through these interactions, I usually think about questions that interest me. And most of the time, these questions are abstract and amorphic, and there's nothing I can do about them. But every now and then, there's a question that I think, oh, wait, I can look into that through my lab or through my research. And I can utilize that questions to try and help my patients. Another project that we have in our lab is that trying to understand how time perception happens in the brain, how subjective time perception You know, we all know that when we walk somewhere, it takes longer than when we come back, right? Just in terms of how much time passed or how much time our brain sensed that passed. So this is a subjective experience that we can influence with different types of stimuli. If you're working or driving, let's say, a well-known route from work to home, it goes by very fast. And if you're driving to a new location, it takes longer, despite the fact that it can take the same amount of time when you look at your watch. And so this is something that through interactions with other people and other people in my lab, we rolled the ball around and eventually reached a point where we have a formed question that we can utilize to understand that process inside the brain.
Yes, it's so interesting how those people and works of art, because I think of works of art as people, like a book could be like a person, can be like a good friend. And you mentioned how important writing was to you and is to you. And those works of art can change as well. Our perception of time can expand it or compress it or make it special or mundane. Do you have works of art that have moved you or that you return to throughout the years?
So I really like Neil Gaiman. He's a British-American writer that
yes.
I feel like he distills the uniqueness of everyday moments through his writings. He takes a very common thing that happens to pretty much everybody and then turns it into this magical and beautiful thing. And he's kind of my hero. There are many painters that I like, and I really like pottery. I think it's the same thing. Turning something into something else through movement is a really interesting concept to me. And these are my main go-tos when I try to get inspiration or to be creative, aside from talking to other people.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love Neil Gaiman. In fact, you probably don't know this. He was one of the first people I interviewed for the creative process, and I painted his portrait with a ladder leaning up the side of his head, a bird flying out of it, and like in kind of a transparent house, because he has a very vivid imagination.
Yes, he's amazing, and he's my hero, and he's a lot of my inspiration for many of our projects.
I think that he's a great communicator as well, and very inspiring, I think, mm-hmm. for people on their roads to creativity. So you've mentioned having children, and as you reflect on the future and those lessons that you've learned from your teachers, your mentors who've been important and guiding you, what do you tell your children in terms of the kind of world we're leaving the next generation? What would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
So I think another thing that makes us human is our generational transfer of information, our ability to distill the knowledge that was passed on to us and then pass it on and give it our unique stamp is again another one of these things that makes us human. And I think the main thing that I've learned from my mentors and the main thing that I would like to pass on to my children is the notion that compassion is the most important thing that we have as human beings. And hopefully I'll be able to teach myself and then them how to be also self-compassionate. I feel this is a very good coping mechanism to this extremely violent and stimulating world that's happening out there. I feel like whatever profession you choose, whatever you choose to study, just remember that there's a human being on the other side. And this is something that social networks and online media are trying to make us forget, that there's actually a person on the other side of that video or text. So I feel like this is the main thing that I would like to pass on to my children to help them remember that eventually we are all human.
It's so true. And I think that's what you do in your work is to honor the life, try to restore the individual to their best, their optimal mental health. And it's not just, as you say, a product at the other end of this social media spectrum. There's more to this life. Thank you, Dr. Ben Shafty, for helping us understand the complexities of high order cognition, creativity, and compassion, and for the important surgical work you do that helps people have a better quality of life by sharing insights into how our minds, spontaneous stream of consciousness, and creativity works. We can imagine better tomorrows. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you, Mia. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for having me. And thank you for doing this great podcast. I really enjoy listening to it.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Ann Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Eva Sanborn. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.